The Colour of Magic, Prologue. In a distant and second-hand set of dimensions, in an astral plane that was never meant to fly, the curling star mists waver and part. See, great Artuin the turtle comes, swimming slowly through the interstellar gulf, hydrogen frost on his ponderous limbs, his huge and ancient shell pocked with meteor craters. Through sea-sized eyes that are crusted with rheum and asteroid dust, he stares fixedly at the destination. In a brain bigger than a city, with geological slowness, he thinks only of the weight. Most of the weight is, of course, accounted for by Berelia, Tubul, Great Typhon, and Jerikeen, the four giant elephants upon whose broad and star-tanned shoulders the disk of the world rests. Garlanded by the long waterfall at its vast circumference and domed by the baby blue vault of heaven. Astropsychology has been as yet unable to establish what they think about. The great turtle was a mere hypothesis until the day the small and secretive kingdom of Krong, whose rimmost mountains project over the rimfall, built a gantry and a pulley arrangement at the tip of the most precipitous crag and lowered several observers over the edge in a quartz-windowed brass vessel to peer through the mist veils. The early astrozoologists, hauled back from their long dangle by enormous teams of slaves, were able to bring back much information about the shape and nature of Artuin and the elephants, but this did not resolve fundamental questions about the nature and purpose of the universe. For example, what was Artuin's actual sex? This vital question, said the astrozoologists with mounting authority, would not be answered until a larger and more powerful gantry was constructed for a deep space vessel. In the meantime, they could only speculate about the revealed cosmos. There was, for example, the theory that Artuin had come from nowhere and would continue at a uniform crawl or steady gait into nowhere for all time. This theory was popular among academics. An alternative, favored by those of a religious persuasion, was that Artuin was crawling from the birthplace to the time of mating, as were all the stars in the sky, which were obviously also carried by giant turtles. When they arrived, they would briefly and passionately mate, for the first and only time, and from that fiery union, new turtles would be born to carry a new pattern of worlds. This was known as the Big Bang hypothesis. Thus it was that a young cosmochelonian of the steady gait faction, testing a new telescope with which he hoped to make measurements of the precise albedo of great Artuin's right eye, was on this eventful evening the first outsider to see the smoke rise hubward from the burning of the oldest city in the world. Later that night, he became so engrossed in his studies, he completely forgot about it. Nevertheless, he was the first. There were others. The Colour of Magic. Fire roared through the bifurcated city of Ankh-Morpork. Where it licked the wizard's quarter, it burned blue and green, and was even laced with strange sparks of the eighth colour, octarine. Where its outriders found their way into the vats and oil stores all along Merchant Street, it progressed in a series of blazing fountains and explosions. In the streets of the perfume blenders, it burned with a sweetness. Where it touched bundles of rare and dry herbs in the storerooms of the drug masters, it made men go mad and talk to God. By now, the whole of downtown Morpork was alight, and the richer and worthier citizens of Ankh, on the far bank, were bravely responding to the situation by feverishly demolishing the bridges. But already the ships in the Morpork docks, laden with grain, cotton and timber, and coated with tar, were blazing merrily, and their moorings burnt to ashes, were breasting the river Ankh on the ebb tide, igniting riverside palaces and bowers as they drifted like drowning fireflies towards the sea. In any case, sparks were riding the breeze and touching down far across the river in hidden gardens and remote rickyards. The smoke from the merry burning rose miles high in a wind-sculpted black column that could be seen across the whole of the Discworld. It was certainly impressive from the cool, dark hilltop a few leagues away, where two figures were watching with considerable interest. The taller of the pair was chewing on a chicken leg and leaning on a sword that was only marginally shorter than the average man. If it wasn't for the air of wary intelligence about him, it might have been supposed that he was a barbarian from the Hubland Wastes. His partner was much shorter and wrapped from head to toe in a brown cloak. Later, when he has occasion to move, it will be seen that he moves lightly, cat-like. The two had barely exchanged a word in the last 20 minutes, except for a short and inconclusive argument as to whether a particularly powerful explosion had been the oil bond store or the workshop of Kerrible the Enchanter. Money hinged on the fact. Now, the big man finished gnawing at the bone and tossed it into the grass, smiling ruefully.
"There go all those little alleyways," he said. "I like them."
"All the treasure houses," said the small man.
He added thoughtfully,
"Do gems burn, I wonder? 'Tis said they're kin to coal."
"All the gold melting and running down the gutters," said the big one, ignoring him. "And all the wine boiling in the barrels."
"There were rats," said his brown companion.
"Rats, I'll grant you."
"It was no place to be in high summer."
"That too. One can't help feeling, though, a momentary..."
He trailed off, then brightened.
"We owed old Freedor at the Crimson Leech 8 silver pieces, he added.
The little man nodded. They were silent for a while as a whole new series of explosions carved a red line across a hitherto dark section of the greatest city in the world. Then the big man stirred.
"Weasel?"
"Yes."
"I wonder who started it."
The small swordsman, known as the Weasel, said nothing. He was watching the road in the ruddy light. Few had come that way since the Deosil gate had been one of the first to collapse in a shower of white-hot embers. But two were coming up it now. The Weasel's eyes, always at their sharpest in gloom and half-light, made out the shapes of 2 mounted men and some sort of low beast behind them, doubtless a rich merchant escaping with as much treasure as he could lay frantic hands on. The Weasel said as much to his companion, who sighed.
"The status of footpad ill suits us," said the barbarian. "But as you say, times are hard, and there are no soft beds tonight."
He shifted his grip on his sword, and as the leading rider drew near, stepped out onto the road with a hand held up and his face set in a grin nicely calculated to reassure, yet threaten.
"Your pardon, sir," he began.
The rider reined in his horse and drew back his hood. The big man looked into a face blotched with superficial burns and punctuated by tufts of singed beard. Even the eyebrows had gone.
"Bugger off," said the face. "You're Bravd the Humblander, aren't you?"
Bravd became aware that he had fumbled the initiative. The shape and cosmology of the disk system are perhaps worthy of note at this point. There are, of course, 2 major directions on the disk, hubward and rimward. But since the disk itself revolves at the rate of 1 every 800 days, in order to distribute the weight fairly upon its supportive pachyderms, according to the refourgule of Kroll, there are also 2 lesser directions, which are turnwise and widdershins. Since the disk's tiny orbiting sunlet maintains a fixed orbit while the majestic disk turns slowly beneath it, it will be readily deduced that a disk year consists of not 4, but 8 seasons. The summers are those times when the sun rises or sets at the nearest point on the rim, the winters those occasions when it rises or sets at a point around 90 degrees along the circumference. Thus, in the lands around the Circle Sea, the year begins on Hog's Watch night, progresses through a spring prime to its first midsummer, Small God's Eve, which is followed by autumn prime and straddling the half-year point on Cruel-tide, Winter Secundus, also known as the Spindle Winter, since at this time the sun rises in the direction of spin. Then comes Secundus Spring, with summer 2 on its heels, the 3/4 mark of the year being the Night of All's Fallow, the 1 night of the year, according to legend, when witches and warlocks stay in bed. Then, drifting leaves and frosty nights drag on towards back Spindle Winter, and a new Hog's Watch night nestling like a frozen jewel at his heart. Since the hub is never closely warmed by the weak sun, the lands there are locked in permafrost. The rim, on the other hand, is a region of sunny islands and balmy days. There are, of course, 8 days in a disk week, and 8 colours in its light spectrum. 8 is a number of some considerable occult significance on the disk, and must never, ever be spoken by a wizard. Precisely why all the above should be so is not clear, but it goes some way to explain why on the disc the gods are not so much worshipped as blamed.
Just go away, will you? Said the rider. I haven't got time for you, do you understand?
He looked around and added, that goes for your shadow-loving flea-bag partner too, wherever he's hiding. The weasel stepped up to the horse and peered at the dishevelled figure.
Why, it's Rincewind the Wizard, isn't it?
He said in tones of delight, meanwhile filing the wizard.